Kevin, thank you very much for that work and for that presentation. The more one listens to the compendium of facts with respect to Building 7, and it becomes clear that there's a sinister work afoot of one sort or another, perhaps very, very detailed and well planned over a considerable period of time. But in order to not just to speculate about that, a legal investigation, a serious investigation, would have to look in depth at all aspects of Building 7. Why Building 7? Why Building 7 when 1 and 2 would likely have accomplished any sinister purpose in terms of the consolidation of power, restriction of liberty and democracy, and give the footloose war on terror an opportunity to proceed throughout the planet? Why add this particular building? I think, and I don't have the answers to that, but I think that an investigation would have to look at who the tenants of Building 7 were. Who were they? Who were all these? Who were the tenants? And what were these various tenant organizations doing? What were they working on? What was the SEC working on at the that might have been particularly sensitive? Now that is another whole other area of investigation, which I suggest really would have to be explored legally. I think the mayor of the city of New York would have to be summoned before any serious investigation. He located or relocated, as you know, the Office of Emergency Management to Building 7 against all advice, all serious law enforcement, security advice. Giuliani insisted on locating his OEM in that particular building. Why was that done? He also is responsible for coordinating the destruction of all of the most important physical evidence as a result of this entire operation. That is the destruction of all of the steel that came down. Now, Article 205 of the New York Penal Code, Section 205-50, called hindering prosecution, says a person renders criminal assistance when, with intent to prevent, hinder, or delay the discovery or apprehension of a person he knows or believes has committed a crime, he suppresses by any act of concealment, alteration, or destruction any physical evidence which might aid in the discovery or apprehension of such person or in the lodging of a criminal charge against him. There is no doubt, there is no question that the physical evidence whereby the steel, the fallen steel in the rubble, was taken away by his Department of Design and Construction before any of the FEMA team could get there. His own people were in there removing that physical evidence from the scene of a crime. It's important. They were cutting it up and they were shipping it out. It was gone. That is a criminal act. The mayor of the city of New York has committed a criminal act. And he, of course, has not been called to task for it, and he's not been investigated about this. But that is a legal area that any investigation would have to look at. You know, in the assassination of Martin King, one of the things that struck me over 30 years ago when I first began to look at that was the fact that early in the morning following Dr. King's shooting, on the morning of the 5th of April, a public works team under the supervision of Memphis Police Department officers were sent into a brushy area behind the rooming house from which Dr. King was shot. As we later proved, he was actually shot from the bushes itself, not from the building. But they went in there early in the morning and they combed that entire area. They combed it and took it down. They crew cutted the bushes that were very, very thick the night before, so that no sniper could ever have been concealed. When you see this, what they had done to this, changing the scene of the crime, and the evidence that was removed was removed, and no one knew or would have known about it. So that happened in that situation. What I have found in the assassination of Bob Kennedy was that very soon after he was shot in the pantry and the Los Angeles Police Department took over the investigation, wooden panel doors in the west end of the pantry were removed. There were eyewitnesses who had seen bullet holes in those doors. Ceiling tiles from the ceiling of the pantry were removed. Because some bullets had gone up into the ceiling area. So there was great tampering with that scene as well. So it seems it is, it's almost a pattern of necessity in terms of covering up illegal activity and crime that the scene of the crime be changed and that evidence be removed. So this destruction of evidence is something that has to be looked on very, very seriously. And we're obviously at a disadvantage because we don't have it. The victims' families are at a disadvantage if they were going to sue anyone because they don't have it. And the prosecution is at a disadvantage because it doesn't have that steel that was cut up and that was taken away and with it, whatever forensic information could be disclosed. So I think these are all areas that one has to look at very carefully in terms of an expanded investigation. Now I'd like to introduce our third expert. I want to have to apologize to all of you. And Tony, somebody to you, because I have an event, a long-standing event in New York that I promised to attend that I'm going to have to drive back, and I'm afraid I won't make it if I don't. So I'm going to have to be content with talking to you again and watching you online, I'm afraid, to do this. Tony Zambati is the third and final expert, and he's going to discuss the structural aspects of the collapse of this building and why the official version of what happened is wrong. Tony's a degreed mechanical engineer with over 20 years of experience performing structural design in both the communication and aerospace industries. He first became alerted to severe problems and unexplained anomalies in the present official explanations for the collapses of the three high-rise buildings in New York City. Since that time, he has been researching the issue himself. And in the past 3 years, he's written and co-authored several scientific papers on the destruction of the three buildings. Here, with respect to a focus on Building 7, ladies and gentlemen, please let's welcome Tony Zambati.
I've been introduced, and Dr. Pepper very graciously mentioned the title. I'm going to be talking about structural aspects of this event. I guess we can move to the next slide. If I can find the page down, here it is. I think I got to adjust this. Can you hear me better? Okay. World Trade Center 7 was an enormous building, 610 foot tall, 47 stories, where each floor was the area of a football field. I know you heard that before, but you really need to picture this. Put yourself in the middle of a football field, and then picture columns every 5 yards around the perimeter, the end zone and on the sidelines. And then in the middle of the football field, another 24 columns, from 20-yard line to 20-yard line, and then three abreast, almost to the edge. Let's say the football field is 50 yards wide, I'd say, these interior columns would come within about 12 to 15 yards of the edge, but there was 24 also there. It was an irregular-shaped trapezoid. I think you've all seen some of this. We're going to have a little bit of overlap and things you've seen before, but I think overall it ties in with the presentation. It was 100 meters long on the north face. That's 329 feet. 75 meters or 247 feet on the south face. 44 meters or 144 feet wide. A football field is 150 foot wide. And it was 610 foot tall. The gross area was 75% of that of the Empire State Building. So that might change your impression of this. And it was built through and over the Con Ed substation. Short guys have to drop it down a little bit. This gives you an idea. These are interior views of World Trade Center 7, one looking down the length from the northeast corner, the other one looking across from the southeast, towards the northeast corner. Just to give you an idea of how big the floor plan was in this building. Each and every one of those 47 floors was this big. And what you're seeing here is it was actually double that. You're seeing one side and one long face. Here's the layout of the columns. It contained 82 columns, 58 on the perimeter and 24 in the central core. And the reason you only see 57 in the upper left is because there was a column 14A put in. Usually that means there was a revision at some point and they couldn't renumber all the other columns because they were marked. This diagram shows the foundation caissons showing that World Trade Center 7's columns were supported through the Con Edison station. A lot of people say that it was supported over it. It was supported through it, not over it. So all the Con Ed substation was basically was like the first two stories of the building. Essentially, the columns went through it. Here's a view of the column. This is the infamous column 79. What you have there is what's called a W40 wide flange beam or column, W14 by 730. The 730 indicates that it is 730 pounds per foot. And that's without the 3-inch or 2-inch wide plates on the side. They're additional. This column at the 12th floor where they said it failed, or started to fail, would have weighed about 14,000 pounds per story. That's 7 tons, just on that one story. And the steel used for these columns had a minimum yield strength of 42,000 PSI. That means, to get an idea of what 42,000 PSI is, for the average person, if you're not aware, that means 42,000 pounds on every square inch. 42,000 pounds per square inch. That's how much strength these columns had. And this column here had around 362 square inches. So that gives you an idea. It's way up in the millions as far as the weight that this column can support. Here's a picture I thought was interesting. It shows a construction worker walking past one of the columns, and you can see by the relative size of the individual and the column that they were quite large columns. In fact, the columns in World Trade Center 7 were so robust that prospective tenants were offered the option of removing entire floors to create high bays, like trading floors. Just take the floor out, and the columns could still support it. But in spite of that, this 610-foot tall, 47-story steel frame building turned into this 5-story rubble pile in 6.6 seconds. This view on the left is interesting to me. It just shows the enormous size. If you look down at the highway and you look at the cars, there's cars down there. They're hard to spot. I'm going to show you a few videos. I know you've seen some, but I think there's a couple here that you may not have seen. And this is the first one. They're very short.
Come on. Shit. It's gone, man.
Oops. It's a side view here. And this is from the Northeast. That building's really moving. And of course, this is famous. This is Dan Rather commenting, and many of you might have seen this, but it's good for those who haven't.
See it. But again, what you're seeing are high shots. Now, here we're going to show you a videotape of the collapse itself.
Describe that.
Now we go to videotape the collapse of this building.
It's amazing.
Amazing, incredible, pick your word. For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
So how much damage did World Trade Center Building 7 suffer from Twin Tower debris? Let's take a look. It was 350 feet away from the closest Twin Tower. I think Graham or Kevin mentioned that. This picture gives you a perspective. You can see World Trade Center 1 there. You can make out the wall. If I can point with it, this is the north face of World Trade Center 1. This is what you would expect debris falling, like an approximate distance from the building, not over here. So FEMA developed a debris map after the event. I guess, you know, they found different pieces that they could attribute to the towers, and so they did this debris map. Of course, you see that the outer ring is light debris, and that's all that Building 7 was in the outer portion of the outer ring. And you can see the Bankers Trust building in the lower right was in the inner ring of World Trade Center 2's collapse. Here's the pictures that the NAST, these are from their report. Most of the pictures in this presentation are from their report. There's not a lot of damage. The southwest corner in the lower right of your photo, they say there was 10 stories gouged out, six columns in that corner. But the other damage was somewhat minimal, and that one corner, imagine if one corner of your house is gouged out. It probably wouldn't lead to an entire collapse of your house. Here's another couple photos that indicate the amount of damage. And when you think back to the light debris zone that it was in, there's a bridge. There was a bridge going from the block, I think, World Trade Center 6 to World Trade Center 7 across Vesey Street. And you can see before and after the collapses. That bridge is not extremely structurally robust, yet it's there. So this shows you the modeling that NIST did. Of course, if you look at the plan view on the left, they just show the southwest corner sort of gouged at the corner, and then they have a larger view of what happened in the center of the building at the top. But then if you look at their model on the right, it seems like the roles were reversed a little bit, where the corner damage got extensively larger, it seems, and the the roof near the roof damage got smaller. These views of these six buildings with extensive damage, everybody should be familiar with. The Oklahoma City building, after the bomb blast, that's the kind of damage it experienced. You see any semblance of any potential for collapse there? I don't. Same thing with the Khobar Barracks in Saudi Arabia from 1996. The Bankers Trust building, the other four are from 9/11. Bankers Trust building that was in that hot, heavy debris zone from World Trade Center 2 was heavily hit. In fact, it's still being demolished by hand. World Trade Center 6 was brutally hit, but it was right under the World Trade Center 1. And a lot of people think there might have been a bomb in there, but debris has a potential to cause a lot of damage. But regardless whether it was a bomb or debris, that building still remains standing. Same thing with World Trade Center 3, which was right under the South Tower. And this is damage after the South Tower collapse and it's a gigantic wedge taken out of it. I don't see a progressive collapse of the rest of the columns. World Trade Center 4 was under Tower 2 also. Half of the building was sheared off. The rest of the building remained standing. There's three main methods of constructing tall buildings. They are steel frame superstructures, in situ concrete, where the concrete is poured at each floor, and you have it's progressively poured and built up. And then there's also the use of prefabricated concrete panels, which are poured and cast at a factory, an off-site factory, transported to the site, and then a crane or various methods, lifting methods, are used to join them, to bring them into position. They're joined, and gravity's relied on to hold them together. We hear quite a bit since 9/11 about this so-called progressive collapse. If you look at it, the only buildings that ever really had an accidental progressive collapse, at least high-rise buildings, are concrete buildings. We've all heard about parking garages collapsing where they removed the forms early. This happened in Atlantic City, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. It's happened in various places in the country. One of the famous ones here, I show here, was in the Skyline Plaza in Bailey Crossroads, Virginia. As you can see, the center of the building collapsed to the ground. I think it was 23 stories or 24 stories high. But it was due to removing the forms prematurely. And you can see also that the rest of the building didn't collapse. It was the area where the forms were removed prematurely that it collapsed in. So the only non-construction collapse of a high-rise building, although it wasn't steel-framed, example in world history is this Ronan Point apartment tower in London, and it was a cheaply built, relatively cheaply built building that they used this method of the precast slabs, the factory-built slabs, because they had housing shortages from World War II. This was going on through into the 60s. And there was a gas explosion at the 19th floor. This was a 22-story building on the one corner. And that caused the 20th through 22nd floors to be unsupported, come down on it, and then they did collapse. But it only collapsed the corner. It didn't progress across the rest of the building, which is, as you'll see, this wants to tell us happened in World Trade Center 7. But to reinforce this point, we hear often that no steel frame building has ever collapsed due to fire. In reality, it's even stronger than that. No steel frame building, superstructure type building, has ever collapsed through itself to the ground for any reason. Any reason. Hurricanes, tornadoes, fires, airplane hits, any reason other than controlled demolition. I'm not talking about a warehouse with a single roof, which is basically one beam. I'm talking about a superstructure where it's a grid stacked one on top of the other. That has never happened. No building with that type of construction has ever collapsed in the history of the world. So what was done in the case of this unprecedented to-the-ground collapse of World Trade Center 7? Was the structural seal saved and thoroughly examined and analyzed? Did NIST really get any? Well, they tell us they didn't, as you heard Kevin discuss, although I know at least one NIST representative was on site in the yards picking through the steel, and that was John Gross, and he was involved in these reports, yet none of the steel was saved. The steel is marked when you build a building, just like any assembly. Most people have had experience putting together some form of assembly. The parts are marked, so you know how to put which one where. That's the same thing in a building. And usually it's embossed so that it doesn't get roughed off or scraped off, as you can see in this picture. I don't know if you... Can you see where it's embossed? The part numbers are embossed? Here's fire engineering professor Jonathan Barnett, he discusses the fact that they didn't have any opportunity to look at the steel from Building 7.
We were surprised that Tower 7 collapsed, we being the team that investigated what occurred on that day. There was some damage to Tower 7 caused by the debris that hit it from Tower 1, but the damage was certainly not similar in scope or magnitude to that caused by the aircraft hitting Towers 1 and 2. When you have a structural failure, you carefully go through the debris field, looking at each item, photographing every beam as it collapsed and every column where it is in the ground, and you pick them up very carefully and you look at each element. We were unable to do that in the case of Tower 7.
So why? Why weren't they able to do that? I didn't take this out of context. There were no additional comments by Dr. Barnett as to why they weren't able to examine the steel on this clip. This was a History Channel clip. The narrator did step in after his comments and say that the steel was removed for search and rescue. But as you can see, there was a clear line of demarcation between Building 7 and the tower, the Twin Tower complex. Vesey Street shows you that. Even if they did have to take it away, why didn't they save it? And apparently nobody was killed. We did hear reports about one Secret Service agent. Apparently he was found. So there was no bodies to be looked for in World Trade Center 7. But the steel was eliminated. So, like I said, none of it was saved except for this one piece. From what we are told, that was looked at in the FEMA Building Performance Assessment Team report. And in that one, they found the intergranular melting and recommended that NIST should pick up on that, which they never did. And of course, here's NIST's statement that no metallography could be carried out because no steel was recovered from World Trade Center 7. And they just compared the properties to other World Trade Center steels. Well, that's not the point. You're not looking at it to determine the properties. We already know that. That was in the specifications. You're looking at it to see if there was tampering. That's what fire investigations are all about. You don't need to look at the steel to test it and see, oh, did it have the properties we need it? That's done when, during construction or beforehand. Nobody does a failure analysis by not saving physical evidence. Nobody. If you were in a private industry and you did that, you'd be out of business. You'd be taken to court if you tried to do a failure analysis without saving physical evidence. A lot of people were upset by this, and Fire Engineering, the editor for Fire Engineering magazine, Bill Manning, wrote scathing articles about it. And I think there was some 9/11 victims' family members. I think Sally Reinhart protested. There was her and other people that protested. They went to Rudy Giuliani's office, or the Office of Design and Construction, and protested this. And they just said, we thought it was prudent to get rid of the steel. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I think it's worthy of an investigation in and of itself. So, let's take a look and see how NIST says the collapse of the steel superstructure occurred without the benefit of having the steel to examine. And I want you to look at this. This shows the skeleton of this building. And look at the enormous grid of steel that's put together here. And that sort of tells you why no steel frame, that's why I'm using the term superstructure. It's not just a roof with trusses. It's a superstructure. It's a grid of steel. While they say, and this is there's a little bit of overlap between what Kevin presented and myself, but it's probably good for you to see a couple times. So they say that these beams expanded and pushed this girder off its seat on this column and caused that floor to fall down, collapsing eight other floors below it, leaving column 79 unsupported laterally enough to cause it to buckle. And that precipitated the entire interior to progress progressively. First, from column 79, if I can look at this, from column 79 back to 81, and then from that's north to south, and then east to west. They say the entire interior collapsed first and left an exterior shell, which then collapsed on its own due to its own being overloaded by its own weight. That's what they say. Of course, they claim there was no shear studs on the girders. Kevin already mentioned that to you. And then there's an inset there where I just put up a typical shear stud installation. And just to explain again how shear studs work, I think everybody's understands if we put two planks of wood together and then we pushed on them in the middle, you can imagine how the one plank on the outside, it's got a different radius of curvature than the one on the inside, and there'll sort of be some sliding movement between them. But when you nail the boards together, they'll bend on the same axis. They'll stay together. That's what shear studs do. They make the concrete slab act with the beam, as though you took another plank and put it on the one plank. It makes it stronger. So when there are no shear studs, it makes it a weaker system. And they're denying that there's any studs on the girder. At least now they are. So they also go on and say in their report that the lateral stiffness of that girder is much less than the axial stiffness of the beams, the four beams or five beams framing into it from the east side. And they actually say two things. NIST did an analysis, an ANSYS analysis. That's a type of structural software, finite element software, that they did themselves, and they determined that the girder walked off its seat, meaning it was pushed off. They then sent that, but they didn't really have, I think Kevin showed you, they didn't really have the amount of expansion needed to get it off the seat. They sent their ANSYS model to a company they subcontracted with who did the LSDYNA model of the global collapse. And apparently, this is implied, they couldn't get it to walk off because their failure mechanism is it got the beams buckled and it pulled them off. So here we have in the same report, they're talking about it's pushed off or it's pulled off. Pushed off or pulled off. They don't make a decision on which one it is. This is amazing. What's that? Well, that's one explanation. So here's lonely column 79, who has all its beams stripped away from it. And what you have to understand, columns, the more slender a column is, the more likely it is to buckle. So it doesn't take a lot of restraint. All you have to do, and I think I mentioned this later, but I'll tell you now, is you have to provide a slight amount of support to the side of a column to counteract any out of plumbness that'll create a moment at the top. And a moment is a force over a distance. If the loads are off center a little bit, it'll tend to want to buckle it. So you just push on a little bit, and it's only like 0.6% of the axial load. You got to push on it from the side. That's it. It's not very much. But anyway, they say that the column 79 was, after these floors collapsed down 8 stories, the column 79 was unsupported for 8 floors. And you can see in the left, they're saying those 8 stories, floor 6 actually through 13. So I guess that's 8, okay. Again, it's being viewed, and they show you column 79 buckling to the north, and that's viewed from the southeast direction. Of course, in the upper view here, they show that the floors, you know, they're saying the floors fell away. Column 79 to 81 buckled. That's the north to south collapse. And then they show in the bottom view, they show the east to west progression. This is all of the interior. The exterior hasn't fallen yet, according to NIST. And this shows you this is all interior also. You're not looking at the exterior of the building. That's stripped away. They're showing if you look from left to right, you'll see the progression that they say occurred. And I just want you to take a good look at that one all the way on the right side. They're saying an entire interior came down before the exterior came down. And we'll look at that later. So again, this is their words describing what I just mentioned to you. and this is these are the results of their model. And I just want to mention that it would have been nice to have saved the steel, or at least photographed it, so we could all see those buckled columns. So here I just want to get into, mention some of them, but the problems with the veracity of the NIST World Trade Center 7 report and why it is so controversial. Of course, Kevin mentioned John Salvarinas' paper. He was the project manager for Frankel Steel, who they were the steel fabricator and erector for World Trade Center Building 7. And of course, he shows that there were shear studs on those girders. On the girders, not only at column 79, but between column 79 and 80 and 81, and to the exterior. And that would, that NIST did not deny that in their earlier report, as Kevin told you also. Again, here's a bigger view of the of a shear stud insulation, and take a good look. In some cases, there's double rows, but they're on every horizontal member. You don't see any members skipped there. And I've talked to other structural engineers that I don't do buildings every day. I'm in the aerospace industry and the communication industry. Mechanical engineers do structural work, but it's ships, airplanes, things like that. But it's the same science. But I've talked to people in the building industry, and they said it would be highly unusual not to have shear studs on those girders. And Salvarinas' paper from 1986, bear in mind, he wouldn't have known anything about a 2001 failure at that point, shows shear studs. So who do you believe? So in addition to not having shear studs on a girder, what does the NIST model do? And Kevin mentioned some of this. It heats the steel beams to 600 degrees C and the girder to 500 degrees C in 1.5 seconds, I believe. It's very fast. But it also, even more importantly, it sets the thermal conductivity of the steel beams to zero, okay? The steel beams are not allowed to transfer their heat. They have to keep it, okay? So they're unrealistically preventing any potential limitation of the temperature. I guess it was tough to get, even as unsupported as the report is, to get it to that point. And they don't heat the concrete or allow it to expand with the steel, even though concrete has the same coefficient of expansion with steel. If it didn't, and all these reinforced concrete structures, things would be breaking up because you'd have differential expansion. It doesn't because the concrete has the same expansion. I think it's engineered that way. There's a reason for it, because you don't want that differential expansion. At any rate, I think it's fair to say those the concrete slabs and the floor pans under them would have been heated, and there would have been some thermal conductivity through those beams and that girder into those floors, but we're not allowed to know that. So the girder that NIST says came off its seats was on column 79 and in the interior and column 44 in the exterior. 79 was a build-up column with the extra plates, so its seat was on the outside. 44, the seat was on the inside because it was a regular I shape. So what happens there is the column is inside the flanges on column 44 in the exterior. So it can't move, it can't translate, but it can rotate. And on column 79, it can both translate or rotate. And that's what that's showing you there. It acts like it's pinned at the exterior, and it's like a roller on the on column 79. What's interesting is earlier, if you look in the upper right view, this shows us, told us that the lateral stiffness of that girder was much less than the axial stiffness of those beams. Okay, we accept that. But now in the analysis where they want to say the beams buckled, we have to ask the question, well, where did the stiffness come on the girder to buckle the beam? Something's got to be stopping the beam. There's no answer to that. They just say it buckled. They don't provide us data. They don't provide us the analysis. They just say what they found happened in their model, and that this is what happened. And they try to justify it. However, when you look at that actual photo of a beam buckling due to thermal expansion is from the Cardington test in the United Kingdom. Kevin showed you a picture of that. That's what thermal expansion buckling of a beam is like. It's not the same as column buckling where the load is still on it. The load is on it until it's relieved, and that's it. It's like pushing your finger against something, and it compresses until it can withstand the load. That's all that happens in a beam. It just does it until it relieves the load. It doesn't continue like a column does because the load's gone once it buckles. And it's very local buckling like you see there. But even if the beams did buckle, suppose NIST did walk away from their walk-off, push-off failure and says, oh yeah, they buckled, they were pulled off. Well, then we have to ask the question, well, the amount of shortening due to buckling could only be equal to the thermal expansion you had, and it wasn't enough to push it off, so how could it be enough to pull it off now? It's very confusing. And additionally, the vertical load capacity of a beam when it has this slight local buckling is generally not upset. And I think you saw in the Cardington photo, the beam just sagged. It still supported the floor. So I've been telling you about the beam. This slide just talks about the push-off or pull-off and the fact that they don't get enough expansion in a 52 or 53-foot beam with the temperature differential they get from room temperature up to 600 degrees. It's just not enough. And in fact, when they say it's 400 degrees, it's much less. It's only about 3 inches. They need 6 inches. They can't get there. So it's impossible. Another impossible situation. I guess they're depending on public apathy. It sounds plausible. In addition, they didn't test this situation. They could have easily put 4 or 5 beams together with a girder and a couple columns, even a one-story situation. We could do it on this stage and heat those beams up to 600 degrees centigrade and see if they can push that girder off. It won't happen. It won't happen because these thermal expansion is a very well-understood phenomena. And even if you put the thermal expansion all in that one direction, they can't get there. In addition to that, why would column 79 buckle if it lost one of the 3 lateral supporting girders? It was still supported in 2 orthogonal directions by the other 2 girders, the one framing in from the west and the one framing in from the south. And I was telling you the standard building design practice is to apply a minimum of 0.6% lateral support at each floor. All right, so that doesn't amount to a whole lot. And those bolts on those girders, the 4 bolts, each one of those bolts could provide 45,000 pounds. That's how much force they could provide. So 4 of them, it's 180,000 pounds. You would only need about 32,000 pounds to restrain the column from buckling. You had basically 6 times that amount. So what does this say about all the rest of the girders? Well, they say their bolts broke too. The problem is there was no fires on floors 5, 6, and 10. 10 was right in the middle of this supposedly slender column. There's no fire. How'd they break the girder connections to the column? They don't say. They just show it in the diagram as being unsupported. They just don't say. And they don't tell us what the girder connections are. They imply they're like the ones on that they do tell us, but they won't provide substantiating analysis for those walk-offs or the failures of column 79 to 81. And again, Ron Berkman, the structural engineer from the Oakland area, was told, who works on buildings every day. The man has a master's degree in structural engineering, and he was told this might jeopardize public safety. And they didn't elaborate anymore. So I think you've seen that the east penthouse goes down first, and then the rest of the building a few seconds later, actually 7 seconds later, the screen wall on top, that middle section up there on top of the building is called the screen wall, and to the west of that is the west penthouse. They went down 7 seconds later, and what's interesting, a lot of people want to say, There's certain people trying to defend the present official story, try to say the collapse occurred over 16 seconds or some 14 to 16 seconds because they include the West Penthouse failure or East Penthouse failure. And I think the question needs to be asked as to whether the East Penthouse failure was a distinct and separate event. And we're going to explore that a little bit here. So what does NIST do to try to replicate that? They say they removed column 79 in a model, and it did show that it could cause the kink that was seen observed in the East Penthouse. However, this doesn't prove that column 79 was removed at the 12th floor where they said it buckled. It could have been removed up high in the building and done the same thing. So these are a series of shots from video still frames from the NIST report. Of course, you see the East Penthouse, and then they want to show you window breakage and that there's daylight at the top. But I want you to notice that daylight's only at the top floor. This building was 144 foot wide. Don't you think if that entire interior collapsed on the east side that you'd see daylight through a lot more windows? There'd be a lot more sunlight shining in? We don't. To me, that indicates that this was a localized event up top. And it was done for a reason I'll get into in a minute. So I'm asking that question here. Probably should have waited till this slide to show you. They're saying the entire east side interior came down the way you're seeing it there. I got to wonder why the east side columns didn't start to fail. They didn't. They waited till the west side failed. They're saying the east side exterior columns didn't want to, they wanted to wait until their brother west side exterior columns went down. That's what they're telling us. At any rate, it's an interesting fact that the East Penthouse, these weren't penthouses, for at least the east side was an equipment penthouse. It wasn't a place like an auditorium or a meeting place for people. It was, at any rate, it was also, if you look at where it was on the roof, it's asymmetric to both the north to south and east to west center line. So I have to ask the question, if it was a controlled demolition, and this is something positioned high on the building and in an asymmetric position, would you want to take that appendage down and bring it down into a safe location so that you don't have a topple? You have to remember the upper building 7 was 610 foot tall, and the upper section was 400 foot tall. It was like 33 stories. So just to show you this is possible, this is just an 11-story building and one of the equipment penthouses on. I want to show you a video of real quick. Do you see the penthouse coming off of there? It flies right off the building. The other question that needs to be asked is how can the core have been completely collapsed before global collapse when the screen wall and west penthouse have just started moving a second before the exterior? They're not even below the roof line before the full exterior comes down. And I want to show you some frame-by-frame slides. It's not as nice and neat as a full-screen thing, but I think you'll get the idea. That's not the right one. I have to open with, I guess. There we go. Picasso lets you scroll it frame by frame, and I think you'll appreciate that. Do you see it? The exterior started coming down. The screen wall and the west penthouse haven't even gone below the roof line. And this is telling us that the entire interior collapsed before the exterior. I'll do it frontwards and backwards for you. Let's just show it a little bit further there. See the movement on the exterior? And the interior is still there. This in and of itself shows in this report is unfortunately bogus. It's thoroughly bogus. I think I went too far here. One of you guys help me with this? Right here? Okay. I'm using somebody else's computer here, so I hope you'll forgive me. Okay, we're back. Another anomaly we can look at here is if this entire complete, as if it needed any more evidence that it's not true. If this complete east to west interior collapse, the way NIST has hypothesized by NIST to occur before the exterior collapse had happened, you'd see an enormous amount of pressurized dust coming out of that building because it'd be generated by floors hitting floors. You know, there's a lot of steel and concrete that would be impacting each other. We don't see any dust until the exterior starts coming down, even though there's supposedly windows broken. I guess I want to show you another frame by frame. Oh, did it again. That's where I'm getting. And this is from the northeast side. You see how now you see the exterior started coming down. It's been coming down for a little bit. And now, not until it comes down for several stories, do you start to see white dust. The blackened windows they show, I want you to think about that. If that was floors collapsing, breaking those windows, you would have saw white dust. The windows would have been black if there was no lighting inside and there was fires in there. And something, some pressure pulse blew out the windows that didn't affect the concrete. Now, what could that be? So there's a final, I think, nail in the coffin of this whole NIST report or travesty that has been foisted on us. And I think some of the good guys at NIST admitted to it. They were forced to admit to it. And that's free fall acceleration of this building, the upper section of this building, for eight stories, eight 13-foot tall stories. That's over 100 feet. Put yourself in that football field again and imagine this thing coming down, all those columns, one every 5 yards, all around you, 24 in the center from the 20-yard line to the 20-yard line, and it comes down at free fall acceleration for over 100 feet due to fire. Well, this was, they were challenged on this. It was a physicist from California. He's a physics instructor. David Chandler discovered in 2008 that it was in full free fall acceleration. And their model only accelerates at about 60% of that, in spite of all their attempts to mimic the collapse. It doesn't match it. And they had to admit to it. And you saw what I had told Gerardo Rivera. This is alluding to that in a natural collapse, even if you could buckle all the columns, the column resistance never goes to zero. There's always remaining resistance. You can't get the free fall, and that's what this graph is showing you. Here's zero. This is what asymptotic means. I'm sure everybody's seen that in school. It's when the graph levels out and never reaches the x-axis. And it's a significant resistance. So you can't reach free fall during buckling. It's impossible. So I think I just explained the significance of all this, But we need to mention one other thing. You can't reach full free fall acceleration if you're crushing other things either, because all of the potential energy has to be being converted to kinetic or energy of motion. You can't use any of that energy, potential energy, for crushing or bending other items, doing any other work. As soon as you do that, you lose speed. It has to slow down. And it doesn't slow down for 8 stories. So this is another reason that this model and explanation is completely non-explanatory. But even though they admitted the free fall acceleration between their draft report in August 2008 and their final report in November 2008, they don't address the implications, the obvious implications. And they want to say, after the interior columns buckled across the building, the exterior columns were left laterally unsupported, normal to the east, south, and north faces. Exterior column buckling spread from column to column as the loads were redistributed until all exterior columns had buckled between floors 7 and 14. They say it buckled over 8 floors within approximately 2 seconds. I'm going to show you a video here. This is pretty quick. I want to show it through again. I want you to think, if you believe that those columns buckled asymmetrically, starting in one corner of the building, around to the other, and you see this thing come down symmetrically. I think it's clear. This 400-foot tall upper section, I don't see how it can possibly come down symmetrically at free fall, while the 58 perimeter columns are buckling sequentially over 2 seconds. Here's an interesting demolition of a building in Fort Worth with a penthouse. It's not as dramatic as this thing, but I think you'll see if you watch that penthouse, it dips in first. The way controlled demolition is accomplished, the way they keep it on the footprint, the intent is to take the interior down just a split second before the exterior. What that does is pull on the exterior, keep it tight inward, and then bring it all down. So just take a look at this. It's worth watching. So it's about 14 seconds long. Did you see the penthouse move down before the rest of it moved down? It's not as noticeable as what happened with the NIST thing, but that's a recognized controlled demolition. And finally, we want to ask, why doesn't the NIST model look like what is observed in the videos of the collapse? Okay? I think we have a right to ask that. This video is about 2 minutes long, so relax and watch it. It's entertaining. Do I have to say anything? I think it has one more shot to show you. So finally, this is my wrap-up here. Present NIST report explanation for the collapse of World Trade Center 7 consists of a series of highly improbable and, in some cases, outright impossible occurrences. And when I say outright impossible, I mean pushing or pulling that beam, that girder off its seat. It's not happening. They don't have the expansion, and the buckling can't do it either, buckled beams. Or the free-fall acceleration. They're impossible. And then I told you that column 79 still had to have support at floor 10. They ignore that. So many of their so-called collapse mechanisms are unobservable, and those that are do not match observation. Obviously, the exterior of their model is dramatically deformed, as we don't see in reality. So you have to conclude that fires could not have caused the observed symmetrical freefall collapse of this building over its full length and width. And if you believe that, you're not alone. You're in good company, because there's several structural engineers, some willing to go on record. Two of my quote here from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, also known as ETH. One is Hugo Bachmann, the other one is George Snyder. And they both say, basically, in their opinion, that the building was, with the utmost probability, brought down by explosives, their controlled demolition. So the view of these professors agrees with that of an increasing number of Americans who have looked into this, and their dismissal of the current NIST report, that it's non-explanatory, and that a new investigation of the circumstances involved here in this unprecedented collapse of this enormous building be undertaken. And I just want to say a couple more words, and I'm done. Engineers find it easy to live in a reality-based world. We have to, because we have to build things to work. You don't have any room for fantasy. It has to work. But I would submit that adults, especially parents, have to do the same thing. You don't want your kid running on ice. You don't want him running with a jagged piece of glass in his hand or dropping glasses on floors. You don't want him driving a car without brakes. So we have to live in a reality-based world because there's dangers if we don't. And that also goes for scrutinizing a report on a crime, that we don't accept a fantastic explanation. It's unacceptable because if we do accept that there's danger, the danger involved is that the criminals that committed the crime are emboldened to continue it and perform other crimes. Okay.